Right now, we're deep into the season of holiday eating. We're going to zero in on Milwaukee and dive into the city's food traditions around the holidays. Our next guest says Polish, Italian, and German holiday traditions are big in Milwaukee, and she joins us to explore the food and the history that surrounds them.
Teresa Nemitz joins us now. She's the owner of Milwaukee Food and City Tours. Teresa, welcome to Central Time. Teresa, what kind of ethnic traditions are still alive and well there in Milwaukee?
Well, definitely the tradition of eating and feasting with friends and family is alive and well, and that's what we love to talk about and take people to do on our various Christmas tours in Milwaukee.
And let's start off with the Italians on your tour. How deep do those roots go?
Yeah, one of the things that we love talking about on our bakery bus tour, for example, is talking about the Italians and how they love to have fig cookies, for example, incorporated into their meals. And then also, you know, when you really look at the Italian traditions, so oftentimes St. Nicholas comes into it. And with the Italians, it's really La Befana, and she was very similar to St. Nicholas. And so that's a tradition that I think that we continue to see in Milwaukee as well as just in the community.
You know, in my family, holidays were a big time to express the ethnic tradition. You might not think about the Polishness all the year round, but when, you know, Christmas and Easter come around, that's when the unique traditions come out and those special foods. Do you see that a lot with different ethnic communities in Milwaukee?
Absolutely. In particular, when we are talking about the Polish, when we're doing a tour, we'll talk to people and we'll say, who here has Polish heritage? And we start talking about the traditions, and we know that the traditions are still alive. One tradition, for example, is that on Christmas Eve, there's oftentimes a supper with 12 dishes on Christmas Eve. And I think that's a beautiful tradition that many families still carry on. And then also a really simple tradition that I only recently found out is that oftentimes the Polish will have an extra table setting, an extra seat at the table, and that's for a stranger that may just come to the family, may need a meal that evening.
Are there specific neighborhoods that you associate with some of these different traditions? I know Brady Street, for example, has an Italian bakery or two.
Yeah, absolutely. Brady Street is really where the Italians have kind of moved and resettled and really reside in Milwaukee. And you really see a lot of those Italian traditions, not only at Certino's Bakery, but at Glorioso's Deli down the street, as well as the Firo's Pizzeria. So a lot of those places just have that wonderful Italian heritage. Then you look at the Germans. Obviously, the Germans, they came and they stayed in Milwaukee, and they really settled on Old World 3rd Street and then the various communities around it. And then the Polish immigrants living in the moon, the shadow of the Polish moon in the Walker's Point neighborhood.
You mentioned those fig cookies as an Italian tradition. I'm not familiar. A fig Newton pops into my head, I guess, and I'm guessing it's not that. Can you describe the fig cookie for us?
Yeah, it's not a fig Newton, but it's just a lovely cookie that's made with some fig filling in it. So it kind of, when you think about it, is a little bit similar to that, but it's just a very fresh, fresh cookie.
My grandparents had a German heritage, and potato pancakes were something that showed up quite a lot. Is that considered a holiday thing, too?
Ooh, I don't really know. I haven't had much experience with the potato pancake, but I do know about the Stollen being a wonderful, wonderful German tradition. So that's one that we see popping up just every single year. People are telling us about their family recipes that they're still using, and people are really talking about, you know, what bakeries in Milwaukee still make that very traditional Stollen dish.
Yeah, we did have that when I was growing up too. You jogged my memory there. My grandfather pronounced it Stollen.
Yes, very good. So tell me, since you have the German heritage, when you were a child, did you used to help to make your Christmas tree, or did your family or your parents make the Christmas tree and then just unveil it to you?
Oh, we always decorated it as a family.
Okay, yeah. So a very, very traditional tradition within the Germans is that the children would never actually take part in making the Christmas tree. Oftentimes, the father would entertain the children while the mother would decorate the tree, and then it was unveiled on Christmas Eve. So that's an interesting tradition that not very often is still used, but is one that we like to talk about on our Christmas tours.
Take that, kids. Well, you two, describe the Stollen to me. I don't know that I've ever had one, Teresa.
Yeah, it's a really, really heavy, moist cake. It's filled with fruit. So think of a fruit cake, but just a much more moist version of that.
And I remember it having a bit of glaze on top and then sort of candied fruits like little jewels on the top of it.
Yeah, usually some nuts and raisins and some fruit. And so everybody kind of has their different recipe or tradition of what they put on the top. But you are correct. Definitely some things that are sprinkled on the top.
And does, you know, with fruitcake, sometimes people put rum or some alcohol on it. Is that something that's ever done with the Stollen?
I don't know.
I always put an umlaut in things. There's no umlaut.
Very good. I don't know. I personally haven't had any with any alcohol in it, so I'm not quite sure.
So what about the Polish foods, Rob? Your area, so Polish foods. No, there's no,
no umlaut there. Yeah.
What are the Polish holiday food traditions?
The Polish, really, they were really big into having a feast where they would lay out all these different dishes and they would have different dishes in each thing. So, you know, maybe the meat dishes and the various bakery dishes. And so that was really their focus, was having not necessarily a particular dish, but 12 different dishes on that Christmas Eve supper.
We're talking about the food tours of Milwaukee and ethnic holiday food traditions in the region with Teresa Nemitz, the owner of Milwaukee Food and City Tours.
And we want to hear from you. What old world holiday traditions got passed along in your family? Is there a favorite baked treat that you make every holiday season? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back now with Teresa Nemitz to talk about Milwaukee's ethnic food traditions and where you can taste that history today, especially over the holidays. Teresa's the owner of Milwaukee Food and City Tours.
And you can join the conversation. What are your holiday food traditions handed down through the generations? If you have a Milwaukee local heritage, Italian, German, Polish background, do you prepare these holiday specialties today? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we go to our callers now. We have Michelle with us in North Chicago, Illinois. Michelle, hi.
Hi.
What is your question?
Well, actually, my holiday tradition, our food is more Caribbean, and it's called pepper pot.
Pepper pot. I've heard of pepper pot. Describe for us, would you?
Well, it's a bunch of meats. You put a lot of meat in. You put, like, salt, beef, and tripe, pigtail, oxtails, and you put a sauce called Kasrip on it, and it's a cassava-based sauce. And you just boil it up and let it boil, and you can eat it over rice or with fresh baked bread.
Now, it's called pepper pot. Does that mean that, Michelle, is it spicy?
Yes, you can put whole peppers in it, like whole habanero peppers or locally grown peppers, just hot peppers in it, and it usually gives it that real kick.
Wow.
Or if you don't want it that spicy, you can put just black pepper in it to give it a milder kick.
Well, that's fantastic to hear about, Michelle. Thank you so much. With all the meat in there and the special sauce, it really does sound like a feast day kind of celebratory food. Have you heard of that one, Teresa?
No, I have not heard of that one. Sounds delicious, though.
Yeah, and people are adding new ethnic traditions to our region all the time. And we're going back to the 19th century and early 20th century for the European, not colonists anymore, European immigrants, I should say. But a lot of new history being built up there all the time.
Yeah, and even I think about St. Nicholas Day, for example, something that is very traditional in Milwaukee in the Midwest, but not necessarily in other parts of the country even. And so every year, you know, we just had St. Nick's Day again, and I see friends and family posting on Facebook, what is St. Nick's Day? You know, folks that aren't in this region, they don't even know about the tradition. So that's one great example of, you know, tradition that continues on, and maybe it just might be regional, but it's a great tradition. And oftentimes, you know, I love the fact that it ties into food too, because you know, really very traditionally, those stockings were filled with fruits and nuts for the children.
Michelle, thanks so much for sharing the pepper pot with us. We'll go next to Connie in Portage. Connie, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to share with you, ours is an English tradition. Our family's from England. And every Christmas, we had suet pudding, which is similar to a plum pudding, only you didn't use any molasses, so it was white. And you steamed it for 3 hours, and then you put a hard lemon sauce on it. And we could not wait for every Christmas.
So, Connie, I gotta say, the word suet in any food is going to put me off a little bit, but this thing's good, right?
Oh, it's absolutely delicious. But you cut the suet up, the fresh suet off the kidney, very tiny. and it melts like in there, and it just makes the most. I mean, our family, it just goes crazy over it. It has raisins in it, and it's just a wonderful. And I also wanted to add, we've always had, I lost my train of thought, but for Stollen, we always used yeast breads for that, never a cake.
Interesting.
And I wondered if that's something different with the cake, you said, a cakey type?
Connie, thanks a lot for that call. Let's start with that Stollen controversy, Teresa. Yeasted versus cake style. Is that a debate?
I don't think it is a debate. I think it's definitely still a yeast version. I think that it's definitely more of a yeast bread, kind of a loaf, as opposed to cakey. So I think that your caller is right on that is the more traditional way to make it.
I want to follow up on her plum pudding comment. She said she's from England. One year, my husband decided to get super traditional, and he made a plum pudding, and it was amazing. Can you still find that kind of old world English dessert anywhere in Milwaukee?
I'm not really sure, honestly.
Steam it, right?
Yeah, I've not heard of any place making it. I know that, you know, there's a lot of these older traditions that have a lot of folklore attached to them. You know, for example, having mince pie is going to bring you good luck in the new year. So, I mean, that would be amazing if places are still making these items. I know Stollen is a great example of something that, you know, a lot of times people say, oh, that's just fruit, like a fruitcake, but it's not. You know, it's a very traditional bread. So I'm not sure.
Teresa, I wanted to ask, as you're giving tours of ethnic bakeries to people, what are the big hits? Some of these ethnic traditions may only appeal to people who grew up with them, but are there things that are, like, these are universal crowd pleasers?
Oh, absolutely. On our bakery bus tour, we visit 6 to 8 different bakeries in a 3-hour time period, and at each spot, we have a different ethnic traditional treat that they get to eat, and then they get to do shopping as well. So we do our Christmas Around Milwaukee bakery bus tours every Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. They are almost all sold out, and everybody loves it. Everyone loves the opportunity to have sweets and treats and learn a little bit about Milwaukee.
Now, Kringle has a big following in Wisconsin. The Racine Kringle is famous. Does that have a particular ethnic root?
Yeah, definitely. It has a Danish ethnic root. We are now doing a Kris Kringle tour down in the Racine, actually, area. And we just did that this past weekend. Great, great tradition. You know, in Racine, when you talk to folks, they want to really talk about what their favorite Kringle is. So very, very popular to talk about what their options are. And on that particular tour, we visit not one, not two, not three, 4 different places for traditional Kringle and samples.
I want to ask before we let you go, Teresa, thinking about Italian bakeries makes me think of cannolis. I don't know if is that a holiday thing, or is that kind of a year-round thing, maybe?
Yeah, that's really a year-round thing. Cannoli actually is really, it started as a symbol of fertility, actually, way back when, and in the springtime. And it's something that has really just become a very traditional Italian or Sicilian treat that people eat all year round.
Teresa, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Great. Thank you so much. Hope everyone can join us on Milwaukee Food and City Tours Bakery Bus Tours.
We're talking to Teresa Nemitz, owner of Milwaukee Food and City Tours. We've been taking a tour of Milwaukee's holiday food traditions and the history behind them. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, our guest tells us how scientists are trying to get a handle on the ethical questions surrounding the emerging technology of gene editing.
First, when you think about a tragedy like gun violence, the cost can seem impossible to quantify, to put a number on. How do you place a dollar amount on a lost life, a gunshot injury, or the emotional hardship that a family might have to go through?
The Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism set out to take a hard look at the parts of gun violence that we can put numbers on. Medical bills are a big part of the story, and so are the costs of legal battles, mental health services, and economic decline in violence-torn neighborhoods.
The result, a large tab for Wisconsin taxpayers. Here with us now to talk about what this investigation uncovered is Sean Kirkby. He's a reporting intern at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Sean, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Well, a lot of intangibles, of course, with gun violence. It might seem hard to put numbers on it. In this report, you try to put numbers on what there can be numbers put on. Where did you start?
Well, we started with looking at an individual case in Milwaukee with a man named Claudier Motley, who was shot about a year ago. And we were working on this with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and a production company in Milwaukee called 371 Productions and a few radio stations. And it's part of a project called Precious Lives, which is taking a look at the impact of gun violence on children in Milwaukee. And so the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel had talked with this person, Claudia Motley, and we started by taking a look at his medical bills, and we started taking a look at, you know, what sort of happened in this case and how, you know, the legal costs got involved, and what about the other, you know, quality of life impacts that he had.
So let's talk about those medical bills first, both for the victim in that shooting, and then the shooter himself was later shot in another attempted robbery, as I understand it. What, I guess I sort of vaguely think, oh, you're the victim of a crime, somebody's going to pick up the tab for you? Not necessarily, though.
Yeah. So Claudier was shot in the jaw and has required about 6 surgeries since then. Part of it's been covered by insurance. A lot of it's been out-of-pocket cost, about $80,000. And then the perpetrator was shot a few days earlier when he attempted to rob a person who had a concealed carry permit. And he was paralyzed from the waist down. And so there were, you know, significant costs involved with his case as well.
And there's a big public price tag all along the way on gun violence. Medical bills, a lot of times, Medicaid, Medicare might pick up the part of the tab. Emergency rooms might have to handle it because somebody comes in and can't pay for it. How much money ends up coming out from taxpayers just on treating the injury itself in gun violence?
So we looked at numbers that were available through the Department of Health Services, and about 60% of, I believe, inpatient hospitalizations are covered by Medicaid or Medicare, which are public insurance companies. And the report, which you can find WisconsinWatch.org, used some formulas that we got from the Wisconsin Hospital Association to put the cost at about $6 million for Wisconsin taxpayers. And that's for emergency room utilizations, inpatient hospitalizations, as well as doctor fees. It does not take into account the cost of long-term care in cases where you have someone who's paralyzed. It doesn't take into account the cost of mental health care, which can also be pricey.
Talking to Sean Kirkby from the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism about the cost, the financial cost of gun violence, of treatment of gunshot wounds, and beyond that, mental health, as he was just saying. Let's go beyond the direct medical costs, though. You also tried to figure out the economic impact on a community of being a place where gun violence happens.
Yeah, and that's very difficult to quantify because there's a lot of aspects to gun violence that you really can't put a cost aspect on. There was a report about a few years back that used 2010 crime data to estimate that in Milwaukee, a 10% reduction in homicide rates would result in an $800 increase in property values, which would have an impact on property taxes as well. But there are other costs, such as the investment that you have in school security systems. There were about 90% of school districts after the Sandy Hook Elementary shooting in 2012 said that they were trying to make some kind of security enhancements. And so there's a cost involved in that as well.
You also looked into the costs of emergency responders, police responding to 911 calls or shot spotter there in Milwaukee, emergency medical staff, fire departments. So what kind of costs rack up there?
So in Milwaukee, the average cost for medical transport is about $1,300, and there were about 250 or so medical transports last year for gunshot victims, so that was about $350,000 or so. There has been an investment in a shot spotter system, which allows police to pinpoint where gunshots happen in the city. And that was about $350,000, and that's about a $320,000 yearly tab as well. For the cost of investigations, it varies significantly from case to case. A lot of cases, they can't identify a suspect in some non-fatal shootings. And in other cases, they're able to find suspects as well.
Also an impact on jobs and the economy. A gunshot victim harder to get a job, keep a job. You write about that in the victim you focused on in the story. Also, a high gun violence area, less likely that businesses are going to invest and start a business in that area.
Yeah, and fear plays a large role as well. And that's something that you can't really quantify, because when you look at stories such as, you know, Claudia Aaron Motley, who was shot on, you know, a Milwaukee street corner, you don't really know how people reading that are going to react, whether or not that would have an impact on, you know, tourism to Milwaukee. And it had an impact on Claudia Aaron Motley's business. He lost about, he estimates it cost him about $50,000-$60,000 in terms of his own work.
And, of course, the worst case, there's a fatality. Somebody dies. We've seen what are about 140 gun or homicides in Milwaukee, not all gun violence there. That's something that it seems like you can't put a value on, and yet, of course, economists, insurance companies, and others do it. What's a human life worth as we assess the impact of violence?
So it's tricky. There have been some estimates that have put it about, you know, 6 million and between 9 million, I think, for the Department of Transportation. And a lot of that is based on risk reduction, how much people are willing to pay to lower the amount of risk of death, essentially. So if you have a community of about, you know, 100,000 people, they're each willing to pay about $100 to reduce that risk of death, you come up with a tab of about $10 million or so.
And that idea of risk reduction actually takes me to a big question here. You're not just collecting numbers for trivia purposes. People are looking to see these costs to see what it's worth investing to reduce this violence. So what kind of ways could people use the data that you and others have collected?
So one of the experts who talked with us for the report, which you can find WisconsinWatch.org, basically talked about that anything that you can do to reduce the homicide rate or the non-fatal shooting rate or violence in general will have eventually pay for itself in the end. And so there are a few proposals that are moving through the Capitol. There are some proposals that are not moving through the Capitol right now that could have an impact on, you know, reducing the amount of gun violence, such as establishing mandatory minimums for certain violent offenders who use guns. That was a proposal that I think has been enacted into law recently by Governor Scott Walker.
You also quoted, I think, a local legislator saying the solution here is to provide jobs, opportunity for people in the area so that they don't turn to violence. It almost seems like a chicken or the egg question. If you can reduce violence, you boost that opportunity. If you can boost opportunity, you might reduce violence.
Exactly. It's a very complex problem with a lot of different facets to sort of address and solve with it. One proposal that has been sort of put forward is also universal background checks, such as closing loopholes that's what proponents would say, for purchasing guns online to make sure that people are getting the background check. That proposal, though, it doesn't look like it'll move that far in the legislature since it's not supported by the Republican Party.
It seems like everybody agrees that there is benefit in reducing gun violence, but there's a lot of disagreement over the best way to do it. Do you, in your reporting and looking at what solutions people are offering, do you see anything that everybody's getting together on, say, yeah, that's one we can all buy into, that's something that might work?
Not necessarily. There was bipartisan support for the use of mandatory minimums, but there were some lawmakers who are concerned about that it's not the best way to sort of address that people aren't necessarily going to do a cost benefit analysis before participating in the crime. There are also other sort of penalties that have bipartisan support, such as one that would apply not owning a firearm to people who commit certain misdemeanors that are violent.
And finally, you talk to some people in the health community who are trying to get us to think, whatever solutions we take, to get us to think of gun violence not just as a law and order issue, but as a public health issue. What kind of things did you hear from them?
Yeah, they're very adamant that this is a public health issue because one of the people that we spoke to works at the medical college, Dr. Stephen Hargarden, describes it as a biosocial disease in the sense that the people who are shot end up in emergency rooms. They often end up being on Medicaid or Medicare programs. And they often face, you know, significant long-term disabilities as well. So it is a problem that has a lot of medical components to it.
All right, we'll leave it there for now. Sean, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thank you for having me.
That's Sean Kirkby. He's a reporting intern at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism. Been talking about his latest report. It's titled, After Guns Wound and Kill, the Bills Add Up for Victims and Society.